This is day one of the 2012 Rogue River Bible School. The speaker is Brother Jim Cowie. His subject is the prophecy of Zephaniah. The title for today's class is The Great Day of Yahweh is Near and Hasteth Greatly. Brother Jim.
Thank you, Brother Mark, and good morning, brethren and sisters and young people. We have before us this week the study of Zephaniah. And Zephaniah is one of those books that we probably categorise as a minor prophet. Hopefully by the time we finish our studies this week, you will go away with the view that Zephaniah is a major prophet. Because Zephaniah is unquestionably one of the greatest stepping stones between the beginning of our Bibles and the end of our Bibles. And we're going to see that this is just not a minor prophecy that might have occurred in the days of Josiah. That was about the judgments impending upon his nation, Judah. It was that, but it was a whole lot more, as we're going to see in our studies together, God willing, this week. Zephaniah prophesied, as you can see from this chart, in the times, the early reign of Josiah, who began his reign, of course, at a very young age, 8 years of age. And by 16, he was seeking Yahweh, the God of David, his father. And by 20, he had introduced a sweeping reform of idolatry in the land without a Bible, brothers and sisters. He had no Bible. The only one remaining was cemented into the corner of the temple. In the repairing of the temple, they found it. He was 26 years of age when he first came across a Bible. An incredibly great reformer was Josiah, a man unique in his times. And Yahweh raised up two prophets, at least two prophets in his days. There were others, but two who had a major impact upon young Josiah. One of them was a relation of his called Zephaniah. And the other one was a very, very close friend who lamented Josiah's death as though it was his own brother. His name was Jeremiah. Both of them had a major impact upon his reforms. So let's just briefly analyse what's before us in this prophecy of Zephaniah. In chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 3, we have the first section, hastening judgments upon Judah. In chapter 2, verses 4 to 15, we have judgment on the nations. In chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, we have the sins of Judah and Jerusalem revealed. In chapter 3, verses 8 to 20, we have a remnant restored and redeemed. And the purpose of the prophecy is clear. It was to encourage a faithful remnant in the face of rapidly approaching divine judgment. It was thundering down upon them. And the Chaldeans were about to come into their land and to sweep them away and to take them back to the home of the idolatry that they had adopted in the days of Manasseh. And we're going to find that the roots of this prophecy are way back in Genesis. Genesis chapter 1 through 35. They're the roots of the prophecy of Zephaniah. And we'll start to expand upon that a little later on this morning. But firstly, who is this Zephaniah? Well, there's a rather long genealogy, which we'll come to in a moment, in Zephaniah 1, verse 1. He was a descendant of Hezekiah, of the house of David, and therefore he was a man with ready access to the young king. He was probably not that much older than Josiah. He prophesied between the years 630 and 621 BC during those early years of Josiah's reign. He was contemporary, as we said, with Jeremiah, who began prophesying in Josiah's 13th year, when Josiah was 21 years of age. He was seemingly, this man Zephaniah, responsible for Josiah's early reforms, which began 1 year before Jeremiah began to prophesy. So Zephaniah unquestionably had an impact upon the young king, Josiah. So what was it like to live in the ecclesia of God of those days, brethren and sisters? Well, Judah was steeped in Babylonian idolatry and worldly practice. They had borrowed every conceivable thing that they could from Babylon. And Manasseh had systematically brought in Babylonian worship for something like 45 to 50 years that he might corrupt and pollute that nation, for which, of course, it was beyond redemption. All of Josiah's reforms were a waste of time, except that a remnant was saved. Those who supported him and those who stood with him. They were a small number, but they were redeemed. And the young people were prepared for the days to come. And young teenagers like Daniel and his three friends and many others who saw the reforms of this king or heard about the reforms of this king were taken away, as we know, to Babylon and played their part later on. It was a sad story, but it was a story that also had some fruit in it, some fruit for the glory of our God. So here was the nation, insensitive after nearly 60 years of apostasy. They were under the irrevocable sentence of divine judgment. You'll recall that when Josiah sent his delegation to hold of the prophetess, the answer came back, "You're wasting your time, Josiah. This nation is doomed. You can't save them." He didn't stop trying to save them. "But you can't save them, but I'll save you. And the best thing I can do for you, Josiah, is to kill you." And he did, 13 years later, by the hand of Pharaoh Necho. It was the mercy of God. And Isaiah 57 made that statement. "None considereth that the righteous are taken away, that they might not see the dreadful things that will fall upon the people that they spent their whole life trying to save." And he was taken away from those judgments. And only a small remnant surrounding him remained faithful. And we know that the attitude of the nation at that time, despite Josiah's reforms and despite the pressure he put upon his people to stand to the covenant, was really only skin deep. They were all wearing masks, most of them anyway. Masks of rectitude, but hearts full of idolatry. That was their problem. And so in Jeremiah 3 verse 10 we read these words. As Yahweh compares Israel in the north, who's now gone for 100 odd years, and Judah in the south, he says this: "Her treacherous sister Judah," he says, "hath turned against me. Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith Yahweh." It was all just an act, because Josiah insisted upon it. He had removed the overt idolatry. He had entered into their homes, and he'd removed idolatry from inside their homes. But it didn't change their hearts. They were too far gone. Why? Well, because, of course, of the work of Manasseh, which we'll come to in a moment. Now, this man's name means "whom Yah hath hid." I want you to notice something very curious about his genealogy. We'll come back to it in a moment. Verse 1 of Zephaniah chapter 1 says this: "And the word of Yahweh which came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah." Now, hands up, any Christadelphian who's going to have children, and you have a son who's going to name him after Pope Benedict the 16th. Anyone? Anyone to name your son Benedict the 16th? Well, that's what the father of Zephaniah did. Cush was the name of the great original prophet of the Babylonian mysteries. More about that in a moment. If you had to ask the question, who wrote the Catholic Catechism? His name was Cush. He was called Bel, from which we get Baal. Goes right back to Cush. The Catholic system began with Mr. Cush. So when this man named his son Cushai, he was naming him after the Pope. Deliberately. What genuine Hebrew would ever do that? Only someone who had been totally corrupted by Babylonian idolatry and worship and doctrine. And that was the case in Judah at the time. Gedaliah is also, of course, mentioned here. The son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah. Gedaliah means "whom Yah has made great." Amariah means "whom Yah promised." And then we have Hezekiah. Did you notice that this is a rather extended genealogy? You know, when you read the prophets, they will say Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, the priest. Okay? Isaiah, the son of Amos. Never does it go back four. Why? Why does it go back four? Well, there's deliberate purpose in this. This is to indicate that this man's heritage, Zephaniah, was in the royal family of the house of David. Because the Hezekiah here in the authorised translation is Hezekiah. No doubt, King Hezekiah. And his name means strengthened of Yah. So the underlying theme of the prophecy of Zephaniah is this. It's all about the salvation of a remnant whom God hid among the Cushites and made great through the one he promised to Abraham and strengthened for himself. So you can make a story out of the names, of the genealogy. And that's what this prophecy is about. And therefore it has a latter-day application, brothers and sisters, because here we are, a very small community called Christadelphians. I was on a plane the other day coming here, and a woman sat beside me. I was reading a book written by Brother Ron Hicks, his latest book, by the way. And it had Christadelphian on the front. And she said, "You belong to a religious community?" I said, "Yes, I belong to the Christadelphians and I'm going to a Bible school. I've just come from one." And she said, "Well, I've never heard of Christadelphians." Now, this woman was quite intelligent because I'd heard her talking to the person across the road. She knew all about opera. She knew all about music. She knew all about what's going on in Southern Oregon. But she didn't know Christadelphians. Unheard of. Okay? Which may, in fact, be an indictment of us when you think about it. However, the point that we need to make about this is that we are a very, very small remnant. And amongst whom do we find ourselves? Well, we have the Roman Catholic Church. It sits at the pinnacle of the churches around us. And we have her harlot daughters. And we have a multitude of Pentecostal-type daughters of the church. We are the only ones, brothers, that we are aware of that have the truth. And here we are, under pressure. Are we not? From the very same things that had corrupted the ecclesia in the days of Josiah and his forefathers through the work of his grandfather, principally, Manasseh. So this is about us. This is really about us. And you're going to see that this prophecy is expansive. It has got to do with the work of our God in reversing what Nimrod accomplished in the past. Why don't you come back to 2 Kings 21? Because here we have the record of what happened that brought about the situation that is being addressed by the prophecy of Zephaniah. 2 Kings 21 and verse 2. We read this. We read about Manasseh being 12 years of age, the son of Hezekiah. In verse 2 it says, "And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh after the abominations of the nations, whom Yahweh cast out before the children of Israel." So here he is. He restored the religion of the original inhabitants of the land. They were Canaanites. You know what Israel encountered at Jericho? You know why God devoted Jericho to utter destruction, brothers and sisters? Because it was Babylonian. That's why. And when Achan took something out of there that was supposed to be destroyed, what was it? Apart from the silver and the gold. A goodly Babylonish garment. What was that there for? Well, for the priests to operate. That was their religion. That's why God said, "Destroy it!" Utterly was the centre of Babylonian worship when Israel came into the land. So he restores it, this man, Manasseh, as Ahab had done in the north prior to him. 2 Kings 21 verse 3 says this, "For he built up again the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he reared up altars for Baal." Here he is, Baal, Bel. Originally Cush, a name handed to Nimrod, his son. Moreover, it says this, "As did King Ahab of Israel, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them." So here is Baal and Asherah, which of course is Astarte, and that came from Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, Phoenician gods of the sun and the moon. All their origins back in the original Babel, or Babylon. The host of heaven means that they were astral worshippers. You know, they worshipped the signs of the zodiac. Now, that wouldn't be the character of our times, would it? We'd have nobody in our society who would look up the paper or get on the internet to see what their star sign was saying for the day or the week, would we? But that's the world in which we live. It's a Babylonian world. Came from those roots. They worshipped the sun, moon and stars and the signs of the zodiac. And you notice, brothers and sisters, in verse 5 there, it says this, in the record of 2 Kings 23, verse 5, he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of Yahweh. That's where he put these things, in the courts of the house of our God. You imagine what that meant to our Father in heaven. So who is this Cush? Maybe I missed one there. 2 Kings 23 verse 11. Let's come across to 2 Kings 23 verse 11. And perhaps just cast your eyes firstly at verse 5. It says this, he put down the idolatrous priests. So this is the work of Josiah. He's going to clean up the apostasy of his grandfather and his father Ammon. He put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained. In the margin of my Bible, for the word idolatrous, it's got Kemarim. And we're going to meet the Kemarim in Zephaniah chapter 1, the black-robed priest. You know where they came from? Well, Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, had two classes of priests. There were those who had access to her. They were the ones who could go inside the inner sanctum, who wore red robes. They were in charge of the door. Nobody got in without them. You know, they were the forerunners of the cardinals. You know what cardinal means? It comes from the Latin word cardo. And cardo means the hinge of a door. In other words, those who control the door. You know, the cardinals today, they're the ones from whence the Pope is elected, by their fellows. And they go inside an inner sanctum, and they hold a conclave. And if someone's elected as Pope, there's white smoke. If there's no one elected, there's black smoke. Well, you see, that was the higher order of priests. But there was a lower order. The ones who had to stoke the fires. And when you're stoking fires, you get black. You know, you get charcoal on you. So what garment would you wear so that it didn't show up? Well, you wore black garments. So her lower order of priests wore black robes. There is the origins of the Kemarim. They're there as large as life in Judah in the days of Josiah. Look at verse 11 of 2 Kings chapter 23. And he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entering in of the house of Yahweh by the chamber of Nathan-Melech, etc. Horses and chariots of the sun, which he burns with fire at the end of that verse. Where'd they come from? Well, they were borrowed from Assyria and from Babylon. So you're beginning to understand, when you get the background, the historical background of Zephaniah, that his prophecy is all about what had happened to Judah in recent times. The last six decades had seen the complete undermining of the faith in the ecclesia and the installation of Babylonian worship in its fullness, in toto. It had dominated that nation for five decades or more. History records that Cush, also known as Kish, and Bel settled in Babylon first. Now, Bel, of course, is part of the name Babel. All right? Babel, confusion. That came from Cush. Here he is. He was the great original prophet of the Babylonian mysteries. And Bel means the confounder. Have a quick look with me at Isaiah chapter 46, verse 1. And see how prominent this character is in the history of the ecclesia of God. So here in the days of Isaiah, we have a prophecy being made. We know that Isaiah prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, but he was most likely put to death by Manasseh, sawn asunder perhaps, as tradition records. So he was around when this work had begun, when the work of polluting the ecclesia had been undertaken by Manasseh. He says this in Isaiah 46, verse 1. Bel boweth down. So here he is. Nebo stoopeth. So there's two principal gods of Babylon. Bel, okay, it's a reference to Marduk, Merodach. There are variations on that name. And you've got Nebo. That is the god Nabu, from which we get Nebuchadnezzar, which means Nebo, defend the boundary. See? So these gods were the subject of divine edicts. They would be destroyed. Come along to Jeremiah chapter 50. We know that Jeremiah 50 and 51 is the basis of much of the apocalypse. You read through these two chapters, you will stumble across references that are taken up in the apocalypse time and time again. So while it's a prophecy of the overthrow of Babylon of old, We know that that is a prophecy of the overthrow of Babylon of the present. So in Jeremiah chapter 50 in verse 2, we read this. Declare ye among the nations, and publish and set up a standard. Publish and conceal not, say, Babylon is taken. Bel is confounded. Cush is confounded. Merodach is broken. Come across to chapter 51, verse 44. Just want you to see that the language is used throughout the times of these two great prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah, because this is what had happened in the ecclesia. It had been overtaken by Babylonian worship. Jeremiah 51, verse 44, we read, and I will punish Bel in Babylon. That's all we need to read. So Babylon was going to fall, and all of those things that had been established by Cush and Nimrod would be undone. Now, Bel was later called Baal and Janus. Now, Janus, the temple of Janus, was the plan for the Vatican. You didn't know that? Faces east, and there's a door at the back, faces west. Janus' statue had two faces, an old face and a young face. One was Nimrod, and he, when he passed off the scene, was replaced by Tammuz, or Zoroaster, his son, young face. Okay? That's why we call a janitor. Because, see, Janus was about, his symbol was a key to unlock doors. So we call a janitor someone who gets in there and cleans up. Okay? Our year begins with January, comes from Janus, the opening. He's the god of beginnings and of openings. Okay? So all of most of what we do today, brothers and sisters, comes from Babylon of old. Our calendar comes, of course, from the Catholics. It's the Gregorian calendar put together by Pope Gregory the 13th. Yep, that's why it's wonky. Okay? Is that a word you use over here? Wonky? No, anyway, you've learnt one. Cush began the form of false religion that spread throughout Mesopotamia and Canaan. You know, there was a formula that applied to Ahab, who was the first king of Israel to introduce Babylonian worship. He married Jezebel, brought Baal worship, Cush and Nimrod worship into Israel. That had happened some a century or so before the events that we're considering. So there's a formula in the prophets. It's this in Micah 6 verse 16. For the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab. So Omri was the statute maker. He was the one who put together the catechism, and Ahab was the implementer. That came from Cush and Nimrod. Cush was the statute maker, and Nimrod was the implementer. So here we have it. So, brothers and sisters, what had happened was that the original Cush, the one back in Genesis chapter 2, becomes the home of Cush and Nimrod and Semiramis, his wife. Are you aware that Semiramis, or at least a portion of that name, when it's transferred to Hebrew, is the name Shinar? Shinar is Semiramis. So in the land of Shinar, they built a tower, didn't they? We're going to talk about what happened way back then, because this is the roots of the prophecy of Zephaniah. You know, we read in Genesis 10 verse 8 that Cush begat Nimrod. And while this phrase here, Nimrod ben Cush, is not precisely the scriptural phrase, it is a Hebrew phrase. Nimrod, the son of Cush, just happens to have a numerical value of 666. Nimrod, 294. Ben, 52. Cush, 320. 666. That's perfectly by accident, of course. Isn't it? Or is it? It's Revelation 13 and verse 18. So I want you to come back now to Zephaniah. We'll have a look at chapter 1, and we're just going to very quickly step you through this prophecy in a general way to see the roots of the prophecy of Zephaniah. In Zephaniah 1 verses 2 and 3 we read this. This is how he begins. He says, I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith Yahweh. Now that's a pretty savage opening, isn't it, to a prophecy. The very first words that he speaks are words of destruction, coming judgment. I will utterly consume all things from off the face of the land. Now this is a very important beginning. Because you see, what we have here, we're given our first clue. The language is drawn from Genesis 6 verse 7. When we read about what's going to be consumed in verse 3, I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of the heaven and the fishes of the sea. You go back to Genesis 6 verse 7, that's where it's coming from. And so Yahweh swept away the apostasy of the first century, first millennia or so, in the flood. And what he's going to do, brothers and sisters, in this prophecy is tell us that he intends to reverse what Nimrod did. Everything that came from Nimrod is going to be reversed, is our first clue. Zephaniah is about reversal. It's about returning to the purity of the truth. It's about removing all the influences of Nimrod and his cronies, that the earth might return to what is called in chapter 3, verse 9, a pure language. In Zephaniah 2, verse 3, we read this language is clearly based upon the flood. And all were consumed except for eight. In other words, there was a remnant whom Yahweh hid in the day of his anger. That's how this section ends in Zephaniah 2, verse 3. It says, it may be ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger. So he is going to preserve a remnant, providing, of course, we're like Josiah and those who surrounded him. That's the key to it. Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 1 and 2, verse 12 and 3, verse 10, you have something very curious. The name Cush occurs three times in just three chapters. So in each chapter you've got, and this is something you can highlight. The one in verse 1, of course, is quite obvious. But come to chapter 2, verse 12. Ye Ethiopians, it begins. That's all I need to read. The word Ethiopians in the Hebrew, Cush. Ye Cushites. That's how you should read that. And chapter 3, verse 10 says this. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, read Cush. From beyond the rivers of Cush. Where were they? Well, that's the rivers referred to in Genesis chapter 2. Remember the ones that came out of the garden and watered that whole area? Where were they? They were in the land of Cush. So you see, this word Cush already is playing a very prominent part in this prophecy. Would you have used the name Cush three times in just three chapters? Don't think so. So why does God? Well, because he wants us to know where we ought to be. We should be back in Genesis. That's the basis of the prophecy. Zephaniah 2 verse 13, he also mentions Assyria and Nineveh. So who was the founder of Assyria and Nineveh? Well, we read of Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 11, that having built Babel and made it into a mega city with four corner post cities and built walls between those cities to protect his people from the wild beasts, more of that later, he then went and made another mega city. He built four cities or towns. One of them was called Nineveh. All right, so he began this mega city with its walls to protect his people from the wild animals. It says this, brothers and sisters, he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh. So he was responsible for Assyria and Nineveh. So he's very prominent, isn't he? In Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 16, we read this. A day of trumpet and alarm against the fenced cities. Yes, he was a city builder. And against the high towers. That's where he began, building a high tower. Genesis chapter 11. You come to chapter 3, verse 6. Zephaniah, I have cut off the nations, their towers are desolate. Yes, he confused their tongue, the tower became desolate. So you see, we've got these hints along the way as to where this prophecy is taking us. But if you wanted any final proof, it's in Zephaniah 3 verse 9. It says this, for then, and this is post-Armageddon, which is the subject of verse 8, and we'll come to that later, post-Armageddon, it says this, for then will I turn, means return, then will I return to the peoples, plural, a pure language. And that word there, language, is the word used in Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. They were all of one lip, all of one tongue, one language. I will return to the peoples a pure language, because, of course, Nimrod brought about the confusion. Babel, their tongue was confounded that their tower might be desolate. Got the point of this? You see where we're going? And if you wanted final proof, Zephaniah 3, 9 to 20 is based on Abraham and Jacob. You know why God called Abraham, brothers and sisters, out of the very heart of Nimrodian apostasy? Why was it he called a man from Ur of the Chaldees? It's the very heart of Nimrod's kingdom, that's why. And he was a man who was an idolater, along with his family. And so Yahweh says to him, I want you, I'm going to start again. All over again, I want one man. And he knew, I'm going to reverse what Nimrod accomplished. That's where our study this week's going to take us. A wonderful culmination. We're going to see the expansive plan of our God. In fact, you're going to see the whole Bible in the course of the study of Zephaniah. That's how big it is, brothers and sisters. A huge, giant stepping stone between Genesis and Revelation. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, they all have their roots back in Genesis. But Zephaniah is the big one. It is absolutely huge in the scheme of things. Takes us to the apocalypse. It's a marvellous story. So, the theme of Zephaniah. Let's get personal, shall we? Let's bring this down to where we want to be in all of this and what this means to you and me. The theme of Zephaniah is spelled out in chapter 1. There's a phrase in chapter 1 that if you highlight will stick out of your page. It is the phrase, the great day of Yahweh. It's used 7 times in this first section of the prophecy up to the end of verse 3 of chapter 2. This is all one section in the prophecy. 7 times. And it's there, of course, to warn of the inevitable and hastening judgments that were about to fall on Judah because of the apostasy of Manasseh, the capital city Jerusalem, and indeed upon all nations, because Nebuchadnezzar's work wasn't just confined to Judah, was it? It was a work of judgment upon all nations. And it was to herald salvation for a faithful remnant and ultimate redemption for Israel and the nations. So that's what this prophecy is there for. So we can sit here this week, brothers and sisters, and absorb the exhortations that will come from Zephaniah. And what we read in this first chapter from verses 4 to 6 is that these judgments of God are to be targeted against 6 classes of people. Now think about this. We don't want to be in any of these classes. Verse 4. I will stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem. I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place. And the name of the Kemarim. So here they are, the black robed priests. That word Kemarim comes from the Hebrew word kamar, which means black or dark. Dark coloured garments they wore as the insignia of their office. With the priests, which means, of course, the Levitical priests or Aaronic priests. So these two priesthoods had combined. The Christadelphians had started an ecumenical movement and they had joined themselves to the Catholics. And here, one Sunday you had the Kemarim give you the exhortation, the other one you had an Aaronic priest. And they never saw the difference. So the first victim is in verse 4, the idols of Baal in Judah. What's called here the remnant of Baal. Rotherham in his margin has the name of Baal. That's what God wanted to get rid of, the name of Baal out of his ecclesia. And the second victim, class of victims in verse 4 is the idolatrous priests and the corrupt Levitical priests who were working in harmony in the early days of Josiah. Then we come to verse 5. And them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops. Here's the astral worshippers, the stargazers. They're the next class. And in verse 5, there's another one. Those with divided allegiances. It says this. And them that worship and that swear. Noted, this is about real commitment. That swear by Yahweh. Well, that's fine. It doesn't stop there. And that swear by Malcham or Molech. Molech was the god you offered your children to. And Hezekiah had been put on the arms of Molech by his father Ahaz. He had been severely burnt by that. Which is why he says, on behalf of Messiah, of whom he was a type, the suffering servant of Yahweh, his visage was marred more than any man. Which was probably one of the reasons why he didn't marry. He was so disfigured by the flames of the fire that sat beneath the arms of Molech. And he was taken off those arms before he roasted to death. You ever thought about that? There was a history here. And Zephaniah came from the family of Hezekiah. Little wonder God raises him up. Got a picture? These are those with divided allegiance. In verse 6 we read this. And them that are turned back from Yahweh. So those who had turned their back on their God. They're the next class. And the final one, verse 6, says this. and those that have not sought Yahweh nor inquired for him. Now here's an exhortation for you and me. You know, in the Hebrew, before the word Yahweh, there is the word Eth, E-T-H. Eth, Yahweh, it should read. Eth means himself. They had not sought after Yahweh himself. The implication is they didn't want to have a personal relationship with God. They were happy enough with this divided and corrupted worship where you could sort of give your allegiance to God, to Yahweh, and also to Molech. It didn't really matter. You know, doctrine doesn't matter, they say. Doctrine doesn't matter. I'm hearing those words today, brothers and sisters, in our community. Doctrine doesn't matter. Well, it does matter. And this is what Yahweh says about corruption of doctrine and practice. So what about this first chapter in particular, but the whole prophecy? Well, seven dominates. Seven times you read the day of Yahweh. Seven times you encounter the word goy or goyim, nations. Seven times you encounter the word am, people or peoples. You know where those words come from? Yeah. Genesis chapter 10. That's the roots in the Bible of these two words, goy and am. And the personal pronoun, I, which you find in Zephaniah chapter 3 verses 19 to 20, seven times is a guarantee that God will fulfill his covenant. Seven's the covenant number. It's also the spirit number. This is certainly a spirit book. You're going to see some wonderful inspiration over the course of this week. Just magnificent inspiration of the Word of God. And if that's all we take away from it, brothers and sisters, that'll be enough. Because we'll go away knowing that this book, we know it already, but we're going to have it confirmed in our minds that this book is inspired. It's the work of our God. And Zephaniah is going to take the whole lot from Genesis and to Revelation and bring it together. We're going to see that huge canvas painted before our eyes. So what about this subject of the day of Yahweh? Like I said, it begins in verse 7 of chapter 1. Hold thy peace at the presence of Adonai Yahweh, he who will become rulers. For the day of Yahweh is at hand. And it was for them, it's 40 years away. Yes, 40 years away. From the time that Zephaniah began to prophesy, it was exactly 40 years when Nebuchadnezzar turned up and destroyed the city and the temple. 40 years. That's significant, brothers and sisters, as you're going to see. He goes on to say this in verse 8. It shall come to pass in the day of Yahweh's sacrifice. He's going to make a sacrifice in Jerusalem. And a lot of people are going to lose their lives because of this mixed up, confused religion that they had. You come down to verse 14. The great day of Yahweh is near. It is near. Can you see the urgency in these words? You know, it's like a train thundering down the track and there's some idiot standing on the rails and you yell, hey, there's a train coming, come on! He stands and says, oh, this is a lovely day. He's gone. He couldn't see the train coming. And the whole nation of Judah couldn't see the judgments coming either. And in 40 years it swept them all away like a storm. You read the language here. The language of verse 14. Even the voice of Yahweh, the day of Yahweh. And then a mighty man shall cry bitterly. The word mighty there is Gibor. So here is the strongest man in the nation. And he's overwhelmed. Crying, oh no! And it just overwhelms him like a tsunami. That's the language. Verse 15. That day is a day of wrath. A day of trouble and distress. A day of wasteness and desolation. A day of darkness and gloominess. A day of clouds and thick darkness. It was coming. I'll tell you something, brothers and sisters. We're in exactly the same position in 2012. The storm is about to break upon humanity again. You know what's going to break? The apocalypse tells us it's about removing Nimrod. And Babylon the Great will be overthrown from the events between Armageddon and the 40 years thereafter. Babylon the Great will be gone and Yahweh will have reversed the work of Nimrod. That's what it's about. And that storm is about to break on us as it was about to break on Judah, for that very same purpose. He sent his people to Babylon that they might be freed from idolatry. And the 50,000 who came back never went back to idolatry again. When the Jews worship money, but they don't ever bow down to gods of wood and stone anymore. Idolatry is gone. They'd adopted it. So he said, okay, this is what you want? Right. Away you go. To the heart of the idolatry that you've chosen. That was his judgment. You see, this is all about that day, but it's not all about just that day. It's about our situation. Because shortly, Armageddon's going to begin. That 40-year period of divine judgment. 40 years of judgment, says Brother Thomas in Eureka, are consumed in preparing the millennial reign of peace and righteousness. And it's on its way. So then, this is a very appropriate prophecy for you and me. This is what is coming. Shortly our Lord Jesus Christ will be in the earth. He will raise the dead. And within 12 months of that, he will have his glorified bride. He will prepare them for the work that is to come. A work that will begin prior to Armageddon. But then Armageddon is going to see that 40 years begin. And it will go on until he's destroyed Babylon the Great. And the work of Nimrod will be over. You know what we're going to celebrate, brothers and sisters, when Nimrod's successor has been destroyed just prior to Christ's universal rule being established? He's going to mark that event by calling the saints back to Jerusalem for a brief interlude in the work that they're doing. And he's going to hold the marriage supper of the Lamb. That's what he's going to do. So joyful will our Lord Jesus Christ be that he's got rid of his competitor, the real Antichrist, the one who sits instead of Christ, sitting in the temple of God saying that he is God. So pleased will he be with that. He's going to call you and me back to Jerusalem, to Zion. And there in the eastern courts of the house of prayer, perhaps almost now complete, he will celebrate with his bride. That's what this is about. I want to finish this morning on the exhortation that comes out of chapter 1 about the twin evils of apostasy and prosperity. They are what's targeted in Zephaniah chapter 1. So let's very quickly run through these verses. Verse 8, we read this. "And shall come to pass in the day of Yahweh's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children." So this was right from the top. "And all such as are clothed with strange apparel." Now what kind of strange apparel might this be? Well, the two Hebrew words mean, as you can see, foreign clothing. Well, it was obviously in relation to the false religion. They were copying, they were mimicking the Kemarim of verse 4. So here was the royal family going around in their black robes, you know. They were quite happy to be associated with the Kemarim that came from Babylon. Verse 9, we read this. "In the same day also will I punish all those that leap not on, but over," it should read. They leap over the threshold because this is a mark of respect. And the respect is because it's the temple of their God that they're leaping over the threshold of. "They leap over the threshold which fill their master's houses," it says. There's no S on the end. It's a singular word in the Hebrew. "They fill their master's house," meaning their God's temple, "with that which they have robbed from other people." Wouldn't it be terrific if when the collection bag came around that you could put $1 million in? But it's not yours. You robbed it from someone. That's what they were doing, worshipping their false gods. Look at verse 10. "And shall come to pass in that day, saith Yahweh, that there shall be a noise of a cry from the fish gate." Fish gate? Yeah. Starts there, you know why? Because the Philistine god, Dagon, had a fish shape. You know where that came from? Babylon. The god Freya. Which is how we get Friday. Which is why Catholics don't eat meat on Fridays. You can only have fish. You've got to worship Freya, the fish god. So, he starts with the fish gate, because it's Babylonian. Goes on to say this, "And a howling from the second." Now this second here is the lower part of the city where they had the markets located. And the markets dominated the lives of people in those days. You know, it was market day every day. when Margaret and I drive to the meetings. We don't have very far to go, but we pass a place where there are simply hundreds and hundreds of vehicles parked at 10 o'clock in the morning. Why are they there? It just happens to be the markets on Sunday, and they can't resist it. They've got to be there. Even though they don't buy it, they've just got to be at the markets, because it's a world of prosperity and materialism and things, is it not? Gadgets. That's the world that we live in. It was the world that they lived in the days of Josiah. Verse 11, we read this. How ye inhabitants of Maktesh. Maktesh? Yeah. That word means the depression. It's also about the lower city, as Rotherham translates it. Again, it's a reference to the marketplace. For all the merchant people, see, there's your proof. For all the merchant people are cut down. All they that bear silver are cut off. This is about the prosperity of those times. And let me read this in verse 12. And it shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with candles and punish the men, the Enosh, the weak mortal men that are settled on their lees, that say in their heart, Yahweh will not do good, neither will he do evil. You know what they were saying? They were saying, well, there's not going to be a reformation. Yahweh will not do good. And there's not going to be any judgments. Where is the promise of his coming? For all things continue as they were from the beginning of the world. Now, we would never say that in our time, would we? We'd never hear anybody like that. Or do I hear when I go around brethren saying, oh, Christ won't come for 50 years yet? Rubbish. He's about to come, as we're going to see tomorrow night, God willing. He's about to come. And some of us, brothers and sisters, some of us in our community are not going to be ready for it. That will be the tragedy. And they were not ready for it in the days of Josiah. This thundering vehicle of divine judgment coming down upon them, they were not ready for it. Why? Jeremiah 48 verse 11. Come back to Jeremiah 48 verse 11. I'll tell you why. Too much ease. Too much comfort. Too much armchair sitting. People think they're going to get in the kingdom in an armchair. Nobody gets into the kingdom in an armchair. Let's be clear about that. None. If you're in an armchair, God's going to topple it over on you at some point. Because he wants you in the kingdom. But that's the problem of our times. Jeremiah 48 verse 11 says this about Moab. Moab hath been at ease from his youth. At ease. And he hath settled on his lees. So this is the phrase that we find in Zephaniah 1. Those that are settled on their lees. Well, of course, it's talking about leaving wine too long in the one container, not shifting it from bottle to bottle. Read on in Jeremiah 48, verse 11. He settled on his lees, and hath not been emptied from one vessel, from vessel to vessel. Neither hath he gone into captivity. It would have been better if he had been. Therefore his taste remained in him, and his scent is not changed. So if you're going to make good wine, you don't just put it in a bottle and leave it there, because what happens is the settlings settle on the bottom. And if you leave it there too long, it makes the wine syrupy and non-drinkable. You've got to keep shifting it from one bottle to another. What does that mean for us, brothers and sisters? It means this. We are better off when we're troubled. We are far better off when we've got problems in life. When we're being shifted from one bottle to another. But if you're too comfortable and you can settle on your lees, you lose sight of things to come. So if you've got troubles at the moment, thank your God for it. Thank him for it. Because it's all about getting you into the kingdom. When we go to judgment, brothers and sisters, it will be a time of prosperity. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow night, God willing. And Zephaniah 1 ends with these words from Rotherham. Neither their silver nor yet their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the indignation of Yahweh. But in the fire of his jealousy shall the whole earth be consumed. This is not just about the land of Judah. This is a prophecy about the whole earth. That didn't happen back then, did it? But it's going to happen soon. For a destruction, he says. For a destruction, surely a terrible one will he make with all them who dwell in the earth. And that is about to fall. And we're living in a time when men are doing what Christ said they would do. Eating and drinking, marrying and being given in marriage, buying and selling, and building and planting. It's a time of great prosperity. And his warning in Luke 17 was this: remember Lot's wife. And there is a struggle, isn't there, brothers and sisters, between what's on the housetop. He which is upon the housetop, let him not come down in that day to take his stuff. The word means gadgets that are in the house. You use the housetop for prayer. You use the house for gadgets. And there's a tension between those two things. Isn't there? A very real tension. So when the day comes, what are we going to be like? Lot's wife tried to secure the present and she lost the future. And the Lord goes on to say this. In that night, he says there will be two. He doesn't mean two men. The word men's in italics. It's not there. Two in one bed. He's talking about a husband and wife because this is based on Lot and his wife. Two grinding together, both in the truth, serving. And the one shall be taken. The word taken, paralambano in the Greek. It means to be taken into a marriage. And the other shall be left. Word, aphiemi. It means to dismiss from a marriage. It's the way it's used in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 10 and 11. So brothers and sisters, the warning is there for us all. May it be that in the day of Yahweh's anger, we like Zephaniah shall be hid and preserved as a faithful remnant.